The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, happy new year and all that. Another year coming with some fabulous podcasts. This is Moments That Rock with me, your host, Tony Michaelides. We're part of the Pantheon Group of podcasts, and thank you for all the support over Christmas. The Led Zeppelin, Henry Smith podcast went down phenomenally well. We also had stuff from The Edge of U2 and Lisa Francesca Nann with some great stories about when she worked in the entertainment industry and met lots of people like David Bowie. And of course, January is Bowie's month. Without further ado, we will get on with today's podcast. Today's guest is Dylan White, and I'll leave it to him to explain how he got into the business and things that happened and rocked his world along the way.
Well, hello. My name is Dylan White, and it's great to be here, Tony, on your podcast, Moments That Rock. So I will deliver some moments that rock my life. Let's start at the beginning then. I basically was born in 1958. I grew up in the 60s, and I listened to all the sounds of the day. I could remember being on a street corner singing She Loves You by the Beatles. And then what happened, in about 67, 68, I had an aunt and uncle come to visit us from America. And they bought me a transistor radio. And it was at the same time that Radio 1 launched. And that transistor radio did not leave my ear. And for some reason, the music started to do something for me. And particular records like Amen Corner, High in the Sky, John Fred, Playboy Band, Gary Puckett, Small Faces, all these records you heard on the radio. One in particular was Felice Taylor, I Feel Love Coming On, which is a sort of Supreme-sounding record. Very hard to get, actually. I'm not even sure it's now available on Spotify. The Northern Soul record used to get played on the radio, and I just loved this record. So I was just growing up in that, and we were watching Top of the Pops on the black and white TV. I can clearly remember the Rolling Stones didn't do Top of the Pops, but they had a promotional video for Jumpin' Jack Flash. Of course, you can now find this on YouTube in colour. And they had face paint on, and they looked scary, really scary. And you think, whoa, what are these guys, the Rolling Stones? And then Jethro Tull came on with Standing on One Leg. But my dad was an amateur classical pianist. And he went, well, hang on a minute, he's playing a flute. That's quite difficult to do. So he was suitably impressed. And as then time went on, so I was involved in just, I just liked the radio. Anyway, as we get into the 70s, my first record I bought was It Don't Come Easy by Ringo Starr. And so became this involvement with music. The first albums I got was probably T-Rex, Electric Warrior, and also John Lennon's Imagine. T-Rex came first, followed by Slade. And again, my mum was having a fit at these fellas stomping around. But my dad clocked that Jim Lee played violin. That's skillful. But as we know, all the Slade could play really well, and that was what they crafted. So my first gig, and you'll like this, Tony, was Slade at the Palladium. And I am, in fact, in a documentary by the BBC called It's Slade, talking about that gig. But that's how it started. And Slade at the Palladium was mind-blowing, mind-blowing. So I rang a mate up. I went, let's go to Heathrow Airport and meet Slade. He went, all right. Voila, Slade come through into the arrivals. That was it. I met my heroes. I've got a poster still signed by them. And there was a snapper there that took a photograph as they left. And that picture turned up in a magazine some months later. And I thought, I've got to learn how to play that guitar. And that was a massive point in my life. So I then got involved with playing more, attempting to write songs and form bands and all the rest of it. So very quickly, between 76 into 77, the Stranglers got from supporting bands on the circuit and playing places like the Croydon Greyhound, etc., to bang, they were at the Roundhouse. And the punk revolution happened, you know, and that was that. Anyway, I had another driver to really attempt to be a successful musician in the early 80s, and I was my most creative period. I wrote a lot of songs and hustled gigs, particularly playing the Rock Garden in Covent Garden. That was a big gig because the Smiths had played there and U2 had played there. So doing all these gigs, sending out demo tapes, getting rejection letters from Stiff Records, getting rejection letters from Virgin, the old bloody lot. I was now got involved with these guys and I started fitting office furniture. Through that, one of the guys had a studio. He said, you can use this studio at a cheap rate if you run my furniture fitting business. So I went, all right, I'll do it. So I acted to the studio. So I started recording more and more music as we went into the 80s. And luck would have it, or so as things befolded before me, a young lad, he was 17, I know this for a fact, was working with me. And he was a big music fan. And he wrote songs. He had a band. I thought, well, all right, I'll be a manager then if I can't be a successful musician. And they could use a studio. And we recorded demos, all the rest of it, and off we went. They were called The Plan, and I made them change their name to Well Loaded. And they were playing the Marquee Club in London, the new Marquee Club on Charing Cross Road. And they had quite a good following. So I then had this money from running this furniture fitting business. So I said, well, we'll make a record. Didn't know what I was doing. Didn't have a clue. And we made this 7-inch single. And Gary Crowley played it. And I said, well, how do you get other people to play it? He went, you need a plugger. I went, well, what's that? Someone who gets records on the radio. Said, go and see this fella called Gary Blackburn, who was at the time doing the Beautiful South and the Farm, and was an established plugger who had worked at Island Records and such like, and had a company called Anglo-Irish. And he then started plugging this band for a fee, and he made some progress. So we're doing all right. We've got to get my deal. I've got to get my deal, you know. So we did a second record, 12-inch single. Paid Gary some money. He gets it on the radio. Funny thing was, to attract attention, I would get either a packet of nuts and put them in with this in a record box with the record, and drop it off with the A&R man saying, this record is sending me nuts. Or I put in bananas. Go, this record is sending me bananas. Anyway, one Friday, I dropped off the record with the bananas. On the Monday morning, this fella comes in the office and he goes, I smell of stale fruit in it. And he eventually tracks it down to this box. Well loaded. He rang me up and went, what are you putting in this record here? So I told Gary all this, and he said, Dill, you've got a knack for promotion. Forget the band, be a plugger. I was on a building site off the Strand in February of 91, and Gary rang me up, come to the Word tomorrow night, I'm there with the Farm. You can start helping me out. And I became his radio oppo, where he would be doing lots of meetings. Everyone had meetings all the time about the plan and what to do. So he'd be in a meeting and I'd go to Radio 1 and get the scripts down to look at what was played. So we got this thing and I could then call him and go, right, there's a play here at the Farm, there's a play of the Beautiful South and so on. And Gary had done the deal to get Suede. Suede were the latest hot band to appear and then Ride, right? And I did a very good job on getting Ride on the radio. And that impressed Alan McGee, which then went, when he went and signed Oasis, he went, right, you're going to use Gary, Dylan and Karen. So and so started that journey of doing Oasis. Well, Gary was a great tutor to me. So Gary would advise me, help me all the way. and I became aware of our competitors. So there were other independents that were on the circuit, and we were all like sort of friendly-ish competitors when we bumped into each other at Radio 1, which is what you did. You had to ring the show's secretary at an exact point in time to get the appointment to then go in and play the records. You really learned that a record had to, don't bore us, get to the chorus. I became very good at editing records. Cut the intro, fade it. Some artists were very agreeable to that. Others didn't like it at all. And this thing about picking singles, and of course the artist would have an opinion, the artists were really too close to the record. So it'd be someone like us, or press agents, or whatever, they're hearing it for the first time, finished. To talk about Oasis, there was a music industry thing called In The City, and it was in Manchester, and Matt McGee had put Oasis on. So I first saw them there, and then he signed them. Then the first official gig was at the Water Rats in the January of 93, it must have been. Anyway, I was there. And what happened was they had this Columbia 12-inch demo, and they were going to go and record the album. They went, well, let's just go to radio with this and see how we get on. Now, Radio 1 had changed. So I had this Oasis 12-inch, and Radio 1 put it on the C list, lowest list. Well, that was never really expected. And then, of course, we went into the singles, you know, Shake and Make, the Supersonic and all of that. And very quickly, of course, the live thing for them was crucial. They began to get more and more notoriety. And the singles all went on the playlist. But I remember flying up to Glasgow for another one of these In The City events, or it was a Radio 1 event. But they'd been added to the playlist like that morning, got on the plane, got off, went into their dressing room. They're like, I'm the hero. Well, they were on the playlist. Well done, well done, well done. You know, they were very appreciative of me in those early days. And in the later days, they were appreciative of me. There was another funny story that happened. They did a BBC London interview with a lady called Lucy Longhurst. It was a known, respected DJ who had new bands on her show in the evening. And she had Oasis in. So you two are brothers then. What would have happened if you had a sister in the back? Lee went, well, she could clean the drums, I suppose. Anyway, they got through this interview and then we left. And Marcus Russell was there. He was like grinning, like, oh, that was funny, wasn't it? And we came out and Marcus must have taken Liam's Noel somewhere. And Liam said, I'm staying in the Columbia Hotel. I said, I'll give you a lift if you want. Now, so Liam got in a car and I drove him like a mile back down the road to his hotel. Liam was so appreciative, right, of everything. He drove it. He led the band. Noel was very quiet, you know, polite and that, and quiet. Liam was the leader. He was the one that wanted to meet everybody. He wanted to be everybody's friend, and he wanted it all to happen.
There you have it. You've been listening to Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michael Edis. And today's guest is Dylan White, telling you about his career growing up first, wanting to be a musician, and then getting into the good old promotion field. And more stories about that with Oasis and you.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment of Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50. and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/Pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
You two coming up after this.
For the moments that rock my world, really, it was working with you too. We started in 2001 from Beautiful Day, and the brief was to keep them on Radio 1. After Beautiful Day, what other things that happened was some of the singles needed editing. And I said, we have to do a radio edit here. And Bono would round me up and said, do whatever it takes to get us on Radio 1. And I was given permission to edit their music. I was the only person in the world allowed to edit their records. And we'd do it, and I would send it to Paul McGuinness's right-hand lady at the time called Sheila Roach. And it would be passed on to Edge, and Edge would approve it. Apart from the albums, they had all this back catalogue, kind of greatest hits. It was this box set. They did an 80s one and a 90s one. There was a track called Elevation. It was great. And there was one bit, it was actually Bono singing. I had to edit it out. And I thought, I can't believe cutting out a bit of his vocal. And I said to look, I'm really sorry, but that little pre-verse bit of your vocal is going to have to go. Just get us on Radio 1. And the other thing was doing what was known as Kids TV. CDUK was the flyer of a show. First thing was, before they went in to do it, come up with the idea, we'll get Cat Deeley to go to Dublin and interview the band. So we worked it out that the four of them would hide in Dublin. And Edge was in a pool hall. Can't remember where Larry was. And they ended up at their hotel, the Clarence, and they found Adam in a hot tub. And then they did this great interview, and that was it, and that sealed the relationship. So the next bit was bring them into the studio. So it was worked out to do, that they would come to London, and Bono said to me, he said, what are you making us do? And he had his kids with him, and the kids were like all excited. They went, that's why we're here, because your kids are watching this, and they love it. And then another idea came along to do Top of the Pops outdoors, outside the BBC TV centre. And they played there. A series of people were allowed in to see them, and others were just clamouring at the gates. Further stuff we did, we went to their houses in the south of France, where Bono and Edge have, you could call them, semi-detached houses.
Oh, my God, you're going to think more time away from the band living next door to them, for God's
and,
sake.
They're together. They're very close. And they got this car, an American car, and they sat in the car with Cat, and they had a CD of the album, not yet released. And they went, right, Cat, we've got to pick the single. What do you want? What do you like? And they bunged the album on, and she listened to it with them, and Bono drove the car. Did an Astoria show. They did like a small gig. That must have been 2001. And that was like 10 years that I'd been working as a plugger. And I'd gone from starting in 91 to looking after U2 10 years later. When they came out and left around the back, they came out the back opposite the stage door. There were little offices right opposite. It's a small little row. And people literally hanging out the windows. And another one, on the No Line on the Horizon album, that I think came out in a earlier part of the year. We came up with a great idea then of the BBC building at the top of Regent Street. I think it's called Portland Place. And it was deemed they could play there. And the funny thing is, you stood on this balcony and you could lean over and see down the road. And the crew and the stage people came and went, yeah, they're a bit low. Let's put a bigger stage in. So it was reminding me of the Beatles at Abbey Road, because they built some sort of platform for them to stand on. And here they just raised it. And U2 played in the early evening. I must have been about 6-7 o'clock. And the police closed off the top of Regent Street. And they played for 5-6 songs, something like that. Because the big thing was, is Bono going to try and climb up that bloody tower and try to do the King Kong thing? But I think the crew had sort of boxed it off, climbing up off that and falling off. So
yeah, you want to have been there in the early days when they didn't have radio mics and the roadie had to follow him with a lead and he was climbing up onto the circle in theatres. It was like, oh my God, where is he going now?
20th anniversary of Live Aid, and they did that in Hyde Park in 2005. It must have been July. They were on early because they had a gig that night somewhere. And they were like, the first band on. And then off on the private plane. It was on the All You Can't Leave Behind album. Post turned up for me, opened it up. And it was a card, just said, from the desk of Paul McGuinness. And he'd written it, and it said, "Dear Dylan, it's fantastic working with you. Thanks, Paul." And I thought, that is class.
Definitely, yeah, I agree. But going back to those early days, I mean, Bono, like, is very much lost in the moment. I mean, if you look at what that total cock-up was at Live Aid, because we just got Pride on the radio, and an audience of 1.4 billion, an opportunity to showcase it on a stage like that, and he goes and walk around and pulls a girl out of the crowd. And that story is just unbelievable, you know, because he was very close to being sacked. McGuinness bought a copy of La Parisienne, and it was how Freddie Mercury and U2 stole the show. So it was kind of a risk that turned into an opportunity.
Yeah, they in all the interviews, obviously various interviews that I've done with them, that does come up, and they talk about that at the time they thought they'd blown it and that Bono was in Egypt because he'd gone walkabout and they couldn't do their song. But then, of course, when the press unfolded, unlike it's not instant like it is now, so the next day, when papers came out, all of a sudden, you know, there's a big picture of him hugging this girl, and it's a moment.
I don't know if you know this, but obviously Live Aid was like, you went to Philadelphia, you know, at a certain time. U2 were the first band that America saw. It was a stroke of genius how they pulled that one off. Because like Status Quo were the first ones in the UK. You're not going to watch a whole day of Live Aid, but you're definitely going to watch the start of it.
Yeah, Bono would have come back from that with the cat that ate all the cream again. Play your instrument and I'll worry about that. He always wrote personal things, you know. One of them, the only reason you want to work with us is because I know Bruce Springsteen.
You learn a lot working with bands, you know. Like I was learning my trade when they were learning theirs, right from the very beginning, you know, obviously taking them to every crappy little radio station.
You two are attention to detail. You know, I mean, I can't speak right now because I'm not working with them now, but like when it was with Paul McGuinness at the helm, and I think those people were like 24/7, like available, do whatever. But you got to hand it to them with this sphere thing, you know, like it was built, right, in some unbelievable technical way with all these outside lights going on and the character and the computerizing. I've seen the thing where the little characters smiling or looking up at aeroplanes or whatever. It's clearly live. And I've seen loads of clips, you know, and they're on this stage with like hardly any equipment. There's no like walls of amplifiers or anything. It's just like minimal equipment. And yeah, everyone is somehow immersed in this magical sort of visual thing. There was one that I spotted though, one of the early shows, I can't remember the song, but Ed started playing. All of a sudden, the guitar went and he ran off and then came back with another guitar. So he ran down his little steps and he ran back up again with another one. And you noticed the guitar sound went, then he came back again. So something had gone wrong with that guitar. I think they've got very clever now with the screens. And how they use them. But yeah, you two at the Sphere, and they had to put on more and more shows. Well, they had this song come out, Atomic City, which was about Las Vegas. That's a new recording they made. And that was the thing, when doing Oasis, and Oasis were like this new phenomena in the UK. So Oasis, like, it's like 93, 94, 95, you know, Wonderwall, all the rest of it, right? And they're doing Earls Court Arena. U2 were like, all right, let's go and check these new boys out. And they all turned up at an Oasis gig. And they went, all right, you're not bad. Come and support us in America. And that was quite, for Oasis, they were like, wait, we're going to support U2 in America.
So what course, year was that?
Must have been 94, 95. And so they were, of course, put on in daylight in some huge place. Like, and they were like, suddenly like, oh dear, we've got a bit of a way to go still. Because they were, you know, just standing there playing. The crowd didn't really know their songs, right? Because they hadn't yet broken it in America. But it was you two just going, yeah, you know, you're new boys, you know, you're on fire. Come and support us. And you two are very good like that, having new young band support. In America, I saw them there, and Kings of Leon were a support band on, well, they, before they released any records, or hadn't yet, you know, so they put them on, like, new acts. Now, Oasis was very quick, really, from 93, 94, the first album, definitely, maybe, then when they get on to What's the Story, Morning Glory, and they were doing Earl's Court. And then, by and then, of course, 95, you had the battle for the number one, and then Nebworth. It was so fast how they took off. So, but that, I mean, it was early doors when they were, you two invited them to support them in America, very early on. Big thing with Oasis, no question, that the Nebworth thing, doing that as a worldwide broadcast. BBC were very helpful. Worldwide, across, well, across BBC World Service, Oasis Live at Nebworth. And it's a great film, Supersonic. Yeah, they were just an amusing bunch. Although what happened with U2, in the end, the age police came down on me, right? And they went, oh, you're getting older, Dylan. Well, we want someone young. And I had a young guy working with me, and they got him to do them. And then the age police came down on him or something, and they're done in-house now. But they're done by the record label as opposed to independent people. But I've gone on, and I am an older plugger, right? So I do a lot of older artists. I do a lot of older punks, like TV Smith from the adverts, or the men, Doctors of Madness. I'll do catalogue work. I'll do a T-Rex catalogue. I love an anniversary, a box set. I do Mijur. Mijur was always doing 40th anniversary tours. So very interesting to do all that. I did the 40th anniversary two times. But I've also gone back to being a musician in my 60s. And my album is now out there called Unfinished Business.
You're own hustler now, are you?
I am, yeah.
That's the best way to be, yeah.
Just had a 3 out of 4 star review in Mojo.
Excellent. Congratulations, sir.
10 out of 10 star review in Viva La Rock. And I've got a 3 out of 4 star review in Mojo. I do gigs. I do open mic nights, like, all the time. And I play. And I'm working on a second album. But I'm not going to rush it. I don't want to rush the second album. Classic mistake.
Excellent. Dylan White telling you about his career, starting off, wanted to be a musician and then managing a band and doing all the things that all of us do when we're growing up. I found that was crappy being a musician, so I gave that up. He ended up plugging and he ended up working with bands like Oasis and U2. I love that bit where he says, like, the age police came along and they brought it in-house. Well, the baby Bono is a mere 64, so of course only a child. Anyway, you've been listening to Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michaeli. This we're on every week. We load these up usually on a Monday. We'll continue to do so. Thanks for your support. Keep going. Subscribe. Tell us what you think. And we'll be back next week.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.